PR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. Today, in this portion of the program, we take a look at the personality test. Millions of us are tested every year. How are the tests used? Are they valid? They have the power to alter lives. Joining us to talk about these tests is journalist Annie Murphy Paul. She is the author of The Cult of Personality, How Personality Tests Are Leading Us to Miseducate Our Children, Mismanage Our Companies, and Misunderstand Ourselves. So as you see, our guest is not a fan of the personality tests. She finds them disturbing. She says the tests have serious flaws, are unreliable, and unfair. Her book examines the problems with these tests. It looks at the history of personality tests, and it offers us some insight into why they are used so extensively. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. I look forward to hearing from you. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-9455. WILL. Outside the local dialing area, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. That number is good anywhere in the continental U.S., so if you're listening on the internet, you can join the conversation. Our guest, Annie Murphy Paul, is a former senior editor at Psychology Today. Her work has also appeared in publications including Discover, Salon, and Self. She is a recipient of the Rosalind Carter Fellowship for Mental Health Journalism. Her book, The Cult of Personality, is published by the Free Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Annie Murphy Paul, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Celeste.
Sure. You note that personality testing has thrived in the shade of casual neglect. How did it capture your attention?
Casual neglect, yeah. When I wrote that, I was referring to a contrast between the way we treat personality tests and the way we treat, for example, intelligence tests, IQ tests, aptitude tests like the SAT, the high-stakes testing that is going on in a lot of our nation's schools. So even though personality tests are out there, they're being used more widely than ever, they're neglected in the sense that we haven't really taken them under the microscope and taken a close look at them and their consequences the way I think we have for those other kinds of tests that I mentioned. So in terms of personality tests coming to my attention, I did start to feel at some point like they were kind of everywhere I turned. When I would surf the internet, they would literally pop up on my screen. I had friends who applied for jobs and told me about personality tests that they had to take, or even friends who were already employed and took personality tests as part of their workplace activity. And then I had friends who had their children taking personality tests either in their classrooms or to get into private school, for example. So I just started wondering. I realized I didn't know much about these tests, where they came from, who created them, whether they really work or not. And just to satisfy my own curiosity, I started looking into those questions and found this relatively unknown story, really, of this group of very colorful, idiosyncratic, in some cases quite eccentric people who, over the course of the 20th century, created a whole slew of personality tests that, in many cases, we're still using today, 40, 50, and 60-year-old tests. And that was a story that I wanted to bring to light and also to explore the research literature, what research psychology had to say about whether these tests were really effective or not.
Yeah. Well, your book is by turns informative, disturbing, and entertaining.
Thank you.
You know, you mentioned aptitude, intelligence, and achievement tests. You know, we really like to test.
Mm.
And you say those tests, aptitude, intelligence, and achievement, have received a good deal of scrutiny, and they've often been found wanting. But the personality test, you know, until now we have your book, The Cult of Personality, hasn't received that kind of scrutiny. Why not?
Well, I think that a lot of people regard personality tests as sort of harmless, frivolous fun. And, of course, sometimes they can be if it's a test that you're taking in a women's magazine or one of these tests online, like which breed of dog are you, which Star Wars character are you, that kind of thing. I would certainly never argue that those tests cause lasting damage of any kind. But I don't think that a lot of people know that, in fact, personality tests contribute to some very important life decisions. For example, they're used in our courtrooms. The Rorschach test, the inkblot test that many of your listeners may be familiar with, is still widely used in our courtrooms, in child custody cases, for example, in emotional distress cases where someone's suing for compensation for emotional distress, to help make parole and sentencing decisions. And then in the workplace, they're used quite widely to screen applicants for jobs, to decide who will get a promotion, to decide who works with whom and on what kind of tasks in the workplace. So these are important decisions that can affect the outcome, that can affect people's lives in very serious ways. And yet, because personality tests are a little bit out of the mainstream or a little bit are looked down upon maybe as not quite serious, we haven't given them the attention that I think they deserve.
Yeah. Perhaps one of the most interesting and disturbing things you write about is the personality typing of children.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of personality tests are used with children?
Well, there's a variety of personality tests for children, just as there are for adults. But as you say, personality type tests are quite often used with children. Often they are modeled on the Myers-Briggs type indicator, which some of your listeners may be familiar with. Or actually, there is a children's version of the Myers-Briggs available. And these classify children according to along these the four axes of the four dimensions of the Myers-Briggs. And I spoke to psychologists and to personality testing experts and authors who advised to begin thinking about your children's type or figuring out their children's type when they're toddlers and even babies, which was kind of shocking to me. And then in the book, I investigate a whole bunch of personality tests that are intended to be used in schools and are being used in schools. And once again, I spoke with a psychologist who had developed one of these tests, and he said to me that he could, after an 8-year-old child took his personality test, he could give that child a computer printout telling that kid what his strengths were and what his weaknesses were and what he should perhaps think about doing with his life. And the psychologist said to me, "Wouldn't you have loved to have had that at 8 years old?" And I just thought, absolutely not. I wouldn't want anyone telling me or any child, anyone who's a child today, what they should be doing. The whole point of childhood, the whole point of growing up is to discover those things, to explore our potential and our capacities. And, you know, we're all growing and changing as people, but children in particular are growing and changing at such a rate that to subject them to a personality test and then on the basis of their answers tell them what their strengths and weaknesses are, I think is very, very troubling.
Yeah. Well, that takes the joy out of the discoveries of childhood and growing up. And
I would think so, yeah.
And, you know, it doesn't leave any room for the elasticity is part of the human being.
Exactly, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, are these tests for kids, you know, there are lots of tests, and we'll go back and we'll talk about the Myers-Briggs test and some of these other tests probably through the interview, but, you know, are they at all useful. Maybe let's talk about, there's a guy, speaking of colorful characters, by the name of Don Lowry, who's developed this thing called True Colors.
Right.
And he's gone from toddlers to teens to whole towns. And, you know, I wonder, well, isn't that a little bit like personality test, quote, test that you might find in the pages of a magazine or online, you know, what Star Wars character are you?
Right, right. Well, since I published the book a couple months ago, I've had a lot of people ask me, are these tests ever a good idea? And certainly I've heard from a lot of people who do feel that they gave the tests gave them insight or some kind of new self-awareness. And these are usually people who are proponents of the Myers-Briggs. For some reason, this is a test that a lot of people really like. And my sense is that what personality tests can do and what they often do in our workplaces especially is provide a moment or an occasion when we can stop and ask ourselves some questions about who we are, what we want, what we see heading forward, and that kind of moment of pausing and asking questions and introspection is very hard to find in our world that's very fast-paced and achievement-oriented. So I think that kind of questioning and introspection is really valuable and something that we should all try to make time for. But I wonder, my question is whether a test with all its capacity to label people and limit them and to impose a very restricted way of thinking about these questions, whether a test is necessary for us to stop and reflect in that way.
But back to this idea of testing and categorizing, that's something that we like to do, at least in this culture. And, you know, going back to that idea of this true colors system, you know, you tell a story in the book about this gathering of high school leaders.
Right.
And it's a way, it's a shorthand for these kids to communicate with one another. And it's a way very quickly for them, while it has the possibility to reinforce stereotypes, it also is a way very quickly for somebody to say, here's who I am.
Yes.
And in a way, then you might, a little light might go on and say, oh, well, because Annie is an orange, she's, oh, okay. And that's okay.
Right, right. Well, I certainly think, you know, we should all take insight wherever we find it. And if a personality test can get someone started on that road of self-reflection and self-awareness, then I have no bones to pick with that. But I do think that the terms that personality tests offer to describe ourselves and conceptualize ourselves are just so limited that if we stop there, if we allow ourselves to be defined by a color or four letters, as in is the case with the Myers-Briggs, we've really done ourselves a disservice. And personality, as you mentioned before, we give so much authority and credibility to testing in our society that I think we tend to put too much weight on the results of a supposedly scientific test. I mean, that's one of the problems that I point out in the book is not only do personality tests have the capacity and the tendency to label and stereotype, but they're also often inadequate as tests. They're not reliable or valid, which are the two sort of criteria that scientists use to determine whether a test is effective. And they can't take into account, for example, the power of situation, which is something that a lot of us know from our own experience, that we may be different at work than we are at home, than we are at school. We may be different according to the people that we're with, the situation that we find ourselves in. And a personality test, although it may give us a very convenient and appealing on some level handle to, as you say, sort of instantly say, well, I'm a green and you're a blue, and that, you know, that makes everything make sense. I think there's a danger in falling into that way of thinking because it really diminishes the complexity and the uniqueness of each of us as human beings.
Yeah. I've got a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us, so
okay.
Let's go and talk with our first caller on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I was thinking that maybe the reason that it's more okay is that personality, unlike intelligence, for example, is something that you kind of pick. So I decided to be this way, and if you want to give me a test that illustrates that, then that's all right with me. Whereas somebody might think, you know, well, I don't need someone backing up how smart I am against other people because I didn't pick to be that smart, and I would pick to be the smartest if I could, but you see what I mean?
Yeah. Well, a couple of thoughts come to mind in response to your comments. One is that the Myers-Briggs, for example, which we've just been talking about, the people who promote the Myers-Briggs will tell you that personality type is inborn and unchanging, and the test is there to sort of uncover that and tell you what your type is. And to me, that's a little disturbing to think that that there's not a lot of capacity for growth or change there, and that it's something that's inborn that you don't have any control over, as you say. I do think that we have some agency in shaping and developing our personalities. And the second thing I was going to say is that actually there do seem to be sort of inevitably, although the Myers-Briggs, which we keep talking about, but the idea behind that is that all types are good ones and everyone has their special gifts to contribute to the world. But in fact, when it gets used out in the workplace, there are certain types that are often valued more than others. I tell the story in the book of one group of executives who were told that they had 6 months to become ENFPs, which was a certain personality type that their company had decided was the best personality type for executives to be. So I think, you know, no matter what the good intentions are of the people who put these tests together, once they're used out in the world, they tend to take on some more troubling characteristics.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's talk with another listener in Champaign on line two. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a biochemist here at the UIUC, and I've found just through, because I'm online all the time, I encounter these personality tests, but I found that the best and most accurate was a platform developed by Alois Trendel, who's a Nobel Prize winning physicist, and then Liz Green, who's a Jungian psychologist, and it's based on astrology. And I found that very odd. I just wanted to find out if you could comment on what you think about astrological personality profiles.
Well, it's interesting. Astrology comes up a couple times in the book, just as in my book, The Cult of Personality, just as a way of comparing it to personality testing, which I see as sort of our culture and our time's way of classifying people. But I try to make the point that this is something that human societies have done in various ways for centuries, and that, you know, at one time it was astrology. So a lot of people still believe in astrology, but then it might have been phrenology, for example, the sort of pseudoscience of feeling the bumps on people's heads and telling their characteristics from that. It may be a bit of an exaggeration to compare personality testing to astrology or phrenology, but I do think that it's we may not be able to see it for what it is because, you know, we're too immersed in our own assumptions. But I think personality testing is really just the latest way that we've found to put people in convenient boxes and think about them in a more simplified way.
Okay, let's talk with another listener. Caller in Eureka, line four, the toll-free line. Go ahead.
Very interesting program. I just have two short questions and we'll hang up. Is the Myers-Briggs test the most widely used and influential? And could you give a bit of background about how and who developed it? Thank you.
Sure. The Myers-Briggs is very widely used. It's given to about 2.5 million people each year, and it's used by 89 of the Fortune 100 companies. So it's very widely used. It's not the most widely used. That probably that distinction probably belongs to a test called the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. But the Myers-Briggs is the one that most of us sort of in the workplace and most of us who are not in sort of specialized settings like mental hospitals and prisons and the legal system, this is the one that you'll encounter out in the workplace. So that's why I think, you know, we're spending so much time on it. As to the background of how it was developed, it's actually quite an interesting story. It was developed by a Pennsylvania housewife named Isabel Briggs Myers with the help of her mother. Neither of these women had any psychological training or background, but they were great fans of Carl Jung, the Swiss psychiatrist, and his ideas, his theories. So they took his theories and turned it into a test on their own. And it was literally created in this woman's living room. She tried out her questions initially on her children and her children's classmates, her friends and neighbors. And now, as I was saying, it's become this sort of worldwide phenomenon. So I think it's interesting to get that kind of background, because so many of us, when we're given one of these tests, when we're handed one at work or in a counseling session or whatever, we don't know where it came from, and we don't know who was behind it. And it's my view, which I try to develop in the book, that a lot of these personality tests actually were made in their creator's own image, in the sense that they reflect the personality of the person who made them, almost as much or more as they reflect the personalities of the people who take them.
And this test, the Myers-Briggs, what are its strengths? What are its weaknesses?
Well, its great strength, which I think is the main reason for its popularity, is, as I said, it's a very positive test. It it tries to give everyone sort of a positive view of their characteristics and their abilities. And a number of the other tests that are in wide use, the Rorschach, the MMPI, are two that I've mentioned so far, they were actually developed originally in mental hospitals, and they were meant to diagnose mental illness. And over the years, they came to be used very widely with normal people, but their orientation is still towards finding sickness, identifying pathology, and that can be a problem when you're using that test with a normal population. The Myers-Briggs, by contrast, was developed specifically for use with normal people, and everyone kind of walks away with a flattering description of themselves. So I think that's one reason why people really like it. I say in the book that it's almost more therapeutic than diagnostic, because it really makes people feel better. I think that's it makes people feel good about themselves. But by the same token, I think the Myers-Briggs tends to give a very shallow and superficial take on people's personalities, in part because it doesn't touch on the more difficult or the more complicated or problematic aspects of a person's personality. And the Myers-Briggs also doesn't have very good reliability. I mentioned that before. That's a term scientists use to describe whether a test of any kind delivers consistent results. So even though the Myers-Briggs people will tell you that the personality types are inborn and unchanging, the research shows that as many as 75% of people who take the Myers-Briggs more than once get a different personality type on the second administration. So a test that is going to give you a different result every time you take it, accompanied by a theory that says the personality doesn't ever change, is going to be a problem. Mm.
Journalist Annie Murphy-Paul, our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of The Cult of Personality, How Personality Tests Are Leading Us to Miseducate Our Children, Mismanage Our Companies, and Misunderstand Ourselves. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with another listener. Line 1, Washington, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Ma'am?
Yes?
I guess the questions I have are, first off, how much consistency between tests do you get in terms of, if you give four or five different tests, do the tests all say the same thing? And also, it seems like in order to have a test, you first have to have a knowledge of what you're testing and a theory of what it is. That is, it seems like you have to have a theory of what personality is and how it works, and then, okay, here's X, so now you can test X. Like, everybody knows what algebra is, so it's easy to come up with a test that tests algebra. But if we had no idea what mathematics was, or if we had like five different kinds of mathematics that competed with each other, coming up with a math test might be kind of tough. So I was curious, has anybody started from that basis of saying, here's how we explain personality,
mm-hmm.
and then based on explaining personality, here are tests that test for these things? And again, the question I asked before, to what extent do different tests correlate with each other?
Yes, yeah, those are really good questions, and the answer is a little bit complicated. Each of the tests that I have been talking about and that are described in the book, the Rorschach, the MMPI, the Myers-Briggs, some others, like one called the Thematic Apperception Test, the NEOPIR. So these are all different personality tests. I describe the eight most widely used personality tests in my book. And each of them kind of operates with its own theory of what personality is and how it works and how it should be measured. But this idea of personality that they're all going after, it does share some characteristics. And I describe in the book the way in which these personality psychologists sort of made personality into what they needed it to be. In other words, in order to measure it the way you'd measure, how good someone is at algebra, personality needed to be static. It needed not to change according to situation or over time. It needed to be precisely quantifiable. You know, you needed to be able to measure it, with numbers. And whether personality really is like that is an open question. To me, it's to describe what a person is like, who they are, those things are not amenable to me to quantification or to fixing, in one particular place and time. So, yes, each of these personality tests has a theory of some kind behind it, but they're all, you know, there's this, I quote one personality psychologist named Stark Hathaway, who eventually became disillusioned with his test, and he said, personality is a ghost. He realized that after many decades of trying to measure personality, it still kind of eluded his grasp. So whether these tests correlate with each other, yes, that kind of research has been done and with sort of varying results. But you get into this almost ingrown kind of world, this hall of mirrors, where a test is judged as good or bad according to whether it measures up to other tests, whether it matches the results of other tests. And very few people have gone into that circle and said, hey, wait a second, can the thing that you're saying that we're measuring, can it even be measured in the way that you're trying to do it? So I think those are really good questions, really deep questions, and ones that I try to wrestle with in the book.
May I ask a follow-up?
Sure.
It seems like the thing that pops to mind as you're describing it is, it seems like personality seems a lot like obscenity.
you know it when you see it.
What?
You know it when you see it.
Exactly. As Potter Stewart said, I can't define it, but I know obscenity when I see it.
Yeah.
And similarly, we can. I think we know. We know in an intuitive way qualitative aspects of personality, just like we know that what's shown on PBS on the sister station to WIL, the television station, is real different than what you'll find on, say, the Spice Channel or Playboy Channel
right.
in a hotel room, you know?
Right.
And some people have actually, in the porn field, have actually gone into it and said, well, maybe we simply define percentage of flesh exposed in certain parts. I mean, they've been able to think about the question and come up with very crude, but at least semi-quantitative. And it seems like in personality,
yeah.
something similar in terms of what getting at getting at the fine nuances of personality is probably kind of hopeless, but being able to tell a real aggressive person from a real passive person or a shy person from an outgoing person, I mean, there are things here where almost more, I mean, you could almost more just ask a bunch of people and say, is this person, you know, outgoingness or aggressiveness or whatever? And then you could say, hey, people who have that, people who tend to be thought of a lot in this seem to do better in this field. I mean, it's a very qualitative kind of thing, but it seems like lots of times people kind of wander through life very clueless, and this could give people some clues.
Yes, yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, but I'm also wary of taking an approach like that because I know people who are shy in groups, for example, but who when you're one-on-one with them or with a small group of people that they know well are the life of the party, you know? And I would never want someone, that's just a small example, but I would never want someone labeled by a test, especially one that may not be scientifically valid and reliable. And I would never want that used by an institution or a boss or a judge to make important decisions about their life. Do you see what I'm saying? So even though those kind of very broad characterizations might be useful on some level, I think we have to be very careful when we're talking about reducing real, complex, unique human beings to, you know, one-word label.
Well, let's thank that listener for his call and go on to our next listener in Urbana, line 2. Good afternoon.
I wanted to know whether you see any value in the closely related matter of vocational guidance tests. I took something called, I think, the Cooter Vocational Preference Record many years ago. And it was kind of interesting. I didn't take it very seriously. And we all know undergraduates who've changed their majors 5 or 6 times, you know. Course of their career. Do you see any value in those if treated with appropriate skepticism?
Right. You know, as I was saying before, I think we should take insight wherever we can get it, but we have to be very careful not to take these tests too seriously, too literally. I did not make a thorough study of vocational tests and, you know, in writing the book about personality tests, but many of them, I understand, were constructed on the same principles as psychology tests, as personality tests. So I would advise the person who's thinking of taking a vocational interest test to find out a little bit about that test, find out whether it's well regarded by psychological researchers, and use it perhaps as a starting point or a jumping off point, but not as sort of the final word, you know, handed down from the experts on what he or she should do with their life.
Sure. Okay, thanks.
Thanks.
Let's talk with another listener, line 4 in Coles County. Hi.
Good afternoon. I was curious about an aspect of research on personality scales. If you took something like a well-constructed test like the MMPI, and you compared the person's own answers to that as opposed to several acquaintances who were well familiar with him, and then you could look at the inter-rater reliability for the different scales, and also how well the different scales correspond or correlate with the person's own taking of the test as opposed to those of the other, the outside observers. You might be able to develop an insight scale from this type of approach.
Yeah, and I have heard of businesses moving towards what they call 360-degree assessments and sorts of things that bring in the opinions of bosses and subordinates and coworkers and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, the more information you have about a person, the better decision that that person will be able to make, that their coworkers and superiors will be able to make. And I also am kind of a fan of something called assessment centers, which are somewhat similar in that they put people through simulated situations, very much like what they'll do in the actual job. And then they have a group of observers rating that person's performance. So it's not just one person's opinion. It's the collected opinions of this group of trained observers. And in the case of the assessment center, unlike, you know, what you were suggesting, it's not someone answering questions on a piece of paper. It's they're actually performing the actions that they'll be required to perform on the job. And to me, that's a more reliable indicator, a more trustworthy guide to how someone will behave than answering questions. You know, the MNPI has all kinds of kind of crazy questions, and I think that we need to judge people on the basis of their skills and experience in the workplace, and not on how they answer a pencil and paper test.
Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the question. Next, we talk with a listener on a cell phone, line one. Hi.
Hi. We did the Myers-Briggs test a number of years ago at an agency I was working for, and one of the things that I found useful, especially in dealing with my own kids, was the concept of what a extrovert was and what an introvert was.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked the idea that an extrovert was someone who recharged in the company of other people, and an introvert was someone who recharged on their own, reading books or whatever.
Yeah.
And it made it a whole lot easier to explain to my kids why the one child who was the extrovert in the family of introverts,
right,
kept trying to, sometimes to our irritation, kept trying to create interactions. And sometimes they were, you know, any interaction was better than none at all.
Yeah.
So that I found useful. But I felt like, you know, the examples that you're talking about with how it's used unconstructively or destructively in an agency, I had difficulty sometimes coming up with a definitive answer, yes or no, on a particular question. And the director of the agency actually said in front of me to the person who was facilitating this, do you think this is a sign of mental illness?
That you had difficulty choosing between the two choices?
Oh, yeah. My goodness. Yeah, I was having difficulty fitting into a category. You know, maybe I'm between personality type or something. I don't know, but I certainly don't feel like I'm mentally ill. And
No. But, oh, my goodness.
You know,
well, those types are very, you know, they're a construction of, you know, as I was saying, this woman, Isabel Briggs Myers, that you certainly shouldn't feel that it's your problem if you don't fit into her
category. This particular person and I had clashes from the very beginning. She walked into the agency. And,
I just thought, wow. Yeah.
So there's another example you can add to your art.
Yeah. Well, I do think, you know, as you say, that some of these ideas about personality can be really useful when we apply them sort of thoughtfully in our interactions with other people. It's the testing and the way the test results are used that I really have a concern about.
Let's talk with another listener. Line 3, a listener in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I was very interested in what you said about how these tests say as much or more about the people who make them up than the people who take them.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you've ever thought about a certain philosophical or maybe just a semantic issue in this whole thing, namely the fact that psychologists have taken words like intelligence and personality that come out of ordinary language and which have been around for a long time, and they give them a scientific value or name.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they did with the intelligence test. People think that if they have an intelligence quotient of 120, that's some scientific thing about your intelligence. Well, the word intelligence has been stolen by psychologists out of ordinary language and given a specialized meaning, which is fraudulent. I mean, it's on the face of it, it's just fraudulent.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no other way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
And originally, intelligence tests were made up as predictors of school behavior. They were made up by educational psychologists, and educational psychologists are among the dullest people on the face of the earth, as you know, anybody who's had any experience with them knows. I wonder if the same thing isn't true of personality, which is an even amorphous and diaphanous term than intelligence, that this is, people have taken this term and forced their own ideas into it, and then they think that they're giving some gift to humanity.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I couldn't have said that better myself. I think psychologists in their zeal to sort of find a key to human nature, they've taken this concept, personality, that, as you say, is out there in the world, available to all of us, and they've said, this is what personality is. This is the thing called personality, and I have a test that can measure it. And what that leaves out is the richness and the variety and the dynamic nature of personality as it exists really in the world. And I think so many of these tests get so far from the human being, him or herself. They're sort of operating on their own plane and comparing, as I was saying earlier, their results not to the actual people that the tests are supposed to describe, but to other tests. So it becomes this very ingrown world that doesn't admit any human reality into it.
Well, yes, I couldn't agree more. It seems to me that if the psychologists wanted to be honest about it, they would have changed the names of these things. They would have called the intelligence test a Joop-Joop test or something like that.
Right.
The information for themselves. But then nobody would pay money.
Exactly.
Come up with this. But
exactly.
That's what should have been done. They should have had a scientific term that describes what people find out quantitatively on this test, and then use that term. But to take a term dishonestly from the ordinary language or, you know, the human spirit and try to quantify it,
yeah,
that's bogus.
Well, if they had done that, especially in the case of intelligence tests, I think a lot of harm could have been avoided because people wouldn't be thinking that intelligence tests really do measure what we all know and think of as intelligence.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. We've got a couple of other listeners here. Let's see if we can get everybody in this afternoon. Listener on line 2 in Champaign, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, the woman, one caller before was talking about introverts and extroverts.
Mm-hmm.
And also she said she was worried about having trouble making a decision about on these tests, but I don't know whether it was about the introverted, extroverted questions or other questions.
Mm-hmm.
But I took one of those tests, and then they told me that I was bimodal. In other words, I was both introverted and extroverted,
mm-hmm.
Which then makes you kind of wonder about these categories at all.
Right.
Valid categories.
Right.
But I'm also just thinking that we need to make judgments about people, and we need to exclude people.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that that's what those tests are made to do, that some people are in and other people are out. It used to be that group dynamics or group formation would, you know, do that, and you would have somebody be different, and then they could be an outcast or a scapegoat.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of the personality tests for jobs, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That in France, they do handwriting tests.
Right, exactly. I think that's exactly how they're used, is to get rid of the complexity that makes making such decisions so complicated and allow for a very simple, straightforward decision to be made, because it's done away with all the naughty questions that would confront someone who was really trying to understand each of those individuals.
And then it kind of like projects it or displaces it onto a test that's supposed to be objective, so
mm-hmm.
the person who's doing the hiring in human resources can take that responsibility off of themselves.
Exactly. I think that's absolutely true, because the human resources person can cover themselves in two ways. They can say to the rejected applicant, well, I'm sorry, we really liked you, but our personality test shows that you just wouldn't fit in at this workplace. You know, that makes it easier. And then to his or her superiors, the HR person can say, well, I had, you know, no one could have predicted that would have been such a disastrous hire. The personality test said, you know, she would fit right in. So it really does, as you said, displaces the responsibility and the accountability for making difficult decisions onto a test and off of the individual who makes the choice.
Speaking of fitting in, let's fit in one more listener. A caller on line 1 in Urbana. Hi.
Yeah, actually, that's what I was going to call about, like excluding people, because I know that in business schools it's well understood that human resources departments are really good at excluding people more than finding the right people or whatever. But at any rate, I wanted to just quickly ask if you have you've encountered any evidence that people or department or companies that rely on these to a great extent end up having a lot more homogenized workforce or not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's hard to it's hard to say what kind of evidence we would have for that, but it's my certainly my strong suspicion that that is one result of using personality tests to screen applicants. Either you get very, you know, people set up these personality tests to find very specific types of people, and so that's one way in which you could end up with a very homogenous, as you say, workforce. And also, there's an element of enforcing a kind of conformity with these tests. So you may end up getting people, if they pass these tests with flying colors, they're the people who are willing and able to fit themselves into conventional categories. And it may be the artistic or the creative or the original people who get left out.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Many questions left on the table, Annie Murphy-Paul, but thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. It's been so interesting. Thank you.
Annie Murphy-Paul has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program. She's a journalist, and her book is The Cult of Personality, How Personality Tests Are Leading Us to Miseducate Our Children, Mismanage Our Companies, and Misunderstand Ourselves. It's published by the Free Press. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the board this afternoon, some interesting numbers coming across. In all the years that I've done this, I don't think I've really seen the numbers line up like this in the corn pit. We, of course, report 6 different contracts. 5 of those 6 today are unchanged, and one of them is just up a quarter of a cent. We'll get a complete look at those numbers and find out why that happened in just a moment when we talk a little bit later with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. Kind of an interesting occurrence in the soy complex this afternoon. Beans were up 8.5 cents. The wire services say that's all on short covering. The funds buying back some of their positions as we get closer to this crop production report due out Friday morning of this week. Now, from the wheat pit, December contract for the day, 310 3/4 the high, the low at 304, settlement price at 304.5. They were off 4.25 at the end of this trading day. March futures down 4.5 in the wheat pit at 317.5, with a low at 17 and a high at 323.5. May wheat futures 330 the high, the low at 323, settled 324. They were off 3 cents. The range in the July wheat contract, your harvest month, 335 to 328, and settled just above that low at 328.5. They were off 5.5 cents at the end of the day. September futures were down 4 cents today, a high at 339.5, a low there at 335, and settled on that low. Once again, that September contract in the wheat pit down 4 cents. December futures in the corn pit starting a series of unchanged markets for the day now. 199 the high, the low at 197.75, unchanged for the Dease corn at 198. March contract at 210.75 high, low at 209.5, very narrow trading range, settled at 210.25. They were unchanged too. May contract unchanged, 218 to 217 the range, settled dead in the center of that 1 cent trading range at 217.5, and they were unchanged. July contract 224.5 the high, the low at 223.5, settled 224 unchanged. And September, they finished actually a quarter of a cent higher today, settled at 232 in the September contract, a high of 232.25, a low at 231.5. And December futures, a 241.5 high, low at 240.75. Couldn't even manage to trade a full penny today. 241, the settlement price, down 1 cent. They were unchanged at the end of this day as well. December oats now, up 2 cents for the day. 142.75 the high, the low at 141.5. Settled 142, two higher. March oats, 149.25 high, low at 148. Settled 148.5, up 2 cents. From the soy complex, a little rally here. Short covering probably is what's been happening throughout the day, but we'll double-check that with Wayne Nelson here in just a bit. 511.25 the high in the nearby November, the low at 503. The settlement price at 510.5, they're up 8.5 cents. January futures, 511.75 the high, the low at 504.5. Settlement price, 510.5, a nickel higher. And the March contract, 518.5 high, low at 511. Settled 516.75, they were up a nickel for the day. May soybeans, 524.75 high, low at 517.5. Settled at 523.25, a nickel higher. And the July futures, a 531.5 high, low at 526. Settled 530.25. Up 4.75. The August contract up 5 cents at 5.32 in the bean pit. Bean meal now, 150.5 the high, the low at 148.75, settled 149.90, and they were up 120. Let me read those bean meals again for you. I was just running through those numbers and reading twos, fours, and sixes as quarters, halves, and three quarters. 150.50, the high in the Deese bean meal. The low at 148.60. Settlement price at 149.90. They were up 120. January contract at 150 higher. At the end of the trading day, they had a high of 151.30, a low at 149.80, and a settlement price at 151.10. December bean oil now, 20.58, the high, the low at 20.07, settlement price at 20.45, they were up 33. And the January bean oil, 20.66, the high, the low at 20.18, settled 20.53, and they finished the day 31 higher. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thanks, Todd. Prices were lower today for livestock contracts. November feeder cattle, 107.95, the high 107.30, the low 107.40, the settlement, that down a nickel. January 102.65, the high $100.25, the low $100.37.5, the settlement, that down 110. March 99.35, the high 96.90, the low 97.15, the settlement, that down 140. December live cattle, 83.65, the high 82.25, the low 82.47.5, the settlement, that down 55. February, 86.62.5, the high 85.50, the low, the settlement 85.65, that down 80. December lean hog, 72.65, the high 71.40, the low 71.90, the settlement, that down 20. February, 72.50, the high 71.50, the low, the settlement 71.92.5, that down 37.5. April, 69.27.5, the high 68.55, the low 68.85, the settlement, that down 60. May, 68.40, the high 67.70, the low 68.05, the settlement, that down 10 cents. And February bellies, 102.40, the high $100.40, the low finishing at $100.47.5, down 190. And let's take a look at the Dow. The number for the Dow now up 23 points, up 24 points at 10,415. The NASDAQ 10 higher at 2049. And the S&P 500 up 3 at 1168.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Mary Allen from Northampton, Massachusetts writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why doesn't the electricity leak out of the outlets if there's no switch on the wall?"
It does. Of course, the power company keeps mum about it. They want you to sweep all those dead electrons up so they can sell you more of them. I plug all my outlets with plastic forks. They're cheap, they're natural insulators, and they make great conversation starters.